listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Four more Palestinians were killed by Israeli fire near Gaza's border. That, according to local medics and the Gaza Health Ministry, as protesters gathered for a fourth week of demonstrations called the Great March of Return. Among the latest fatalities were a 15-year-old boy from Jabalia and a 29-year-old reportedly shot in an area east of Khan Yunis. A 25-year-old man died after being shot east of Jabalia, while a 24-year-old man was reportedly shot dead by Israeli fire in the northern Gaza Strip. According to Israel's military, some 3,000 Palestinian protesters took part in Friday's demonstration. The six-week protest began March 30th and is set to continue until May 15th, the anniversary of the so-called Nakba, or Great Catastrophe, when Palestinians were forced off their land during the establishment of the State of Israel. That date is also celebrated by the Israelis as Independence Day. Among the measures employed by the Israeli military against protesters was tear gas, and a journalist's credentials did not protect Hind Kudari, who was reporting for RT, from herself being tear gassed by Israel's military.
Oh my God, it's crazy. Everyone is running from the tear gas canisters. They're randomly shooting tear gas on everyone. Paramedics, journalists, civilians, protesters, everyone. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. We were covering the protest and coming closer to the protesters, and suddenly they intensively started to fire tear gas, and we were trapped by at least five tear gas canisters. We started to feel our nose and eyes burning. We couldn't even take a breath, and at that time I literally fainted. I didn't know what was going on, and it was not only me. There were paramedics, and there was a journalist that was directly shot in his hand. The Israeli forces are actually in intending to target the Palestinian journalists and the paramedics. What's going on is ridiculous, how they're targeting everyone and no one's safe. Either it's a protester, a civilian, a paramedic, or a journalist.
Thus far, some 35 Palestinians have been killed and thousands wounded by Israeli gunfire. On Friday, Riyad Mansour, the permanent observer of the State of Palestine to the United Nations, held a press encounter on the situation in Palestine at UN headquarters in New York.
I want to thank my colleagues, the ambassador of Tunisia, the chair of the Arab group for this month, my colleague, the chargé of Kuwait, the Arab representative in the Security Council, and the ambassador of the League of Arab States, for being together now for the fourth week in a row after the continuation of the Israeli massacres against Palestinian civilians who are demonstrating in a peaceful way, especially in the Gaza Strip, but of course in other parts of the occupied territory and even beyond. As I was coming today to the UN, I passed by the intersection of 42nd and 2nd Avenue, and there are hundreds of Jews demonstrating against the Israeli mission, demanding condemnation of this massacre against the civilian population and requesting that it should be stopped and other things that they're asking for. We salute all those who are expressing solidarity with the Palestinian everywhere. And of course, we salute our people for their bravery and their steadfastness. We honor our martyrs and our injured people. And even yesterday, 20,000 Palestinians, Israelis demonstrated commemorating the Nakba, and which is for the Israelis' independence, but for the Palestinians' catastrophe and Nakba, as was articulated by Ayman Oude in an editorial article in the New York Times. For us, we send a letter, as usual, to the President of the Security Council, to the Secretary General, and to the President of the General Assembly, documenting all these crimes, including killing a child, which led to a brave statement by Mladenov, in which he said that he is now asking for an independent investigation in the killing of this child, and he received a message from the chief of staff of the Israeli army telling him that that was not helpful, and Mladenov responded by saying, really, this is not helpful, killing Palestinian children is helpful for moving in the direction of peace. So as you see, the things are now unfolding of not leaving the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip to be alone, but people everywhere are rallying behind their peaceful call for their just cause and for their demand to return in accordance with Resolution 141. Of course, I reflected also in the letter the instructions from my leadership to demand from the Security Council to seriously consider providing protection for the civilian population, since Israel abdicated its responsibility to provide protection for the civilian population, then it becomes the duty of the international community to deal seriously with this issue and to provide protection for the civilian population. Also, I just want to bring to your attention that I had a discussion with my colleague in Geneva today after the results of what happened today on the ground, and he will be beginning the consultations with members of the Human Rights Council so that the Council to shoulder its responsibility with the possibility of moving in the direction of the independent and transparent investigation. In this regard, we salute the special rapporteurs in Geneva who have been calling for investigation by the UN, and they do not accept that Israel, who is committing the crime, to be able to investigate itself. What is needed is an independent and transparent commission to conduct the investigation on these crimes, and it has to be established by the UN, and it has to be independent and transparent, because Israel cannot conduct such an independent investigation. And we support these calls by the special rapporteurs in Geneva, and we hope that this is creating the appropriate atmosphere for moving in the direction of the investigation, and most likely might be in the direction of the Council on Human Rights. We will continue to follow up these developments. We reiterate our position that what the Secretary General called for, to have an independent and transparent investigation, is still warranted, is correct. After we reached almost close to 40 Palestinian civilians killed and more than 4,500 injured, it seems that the Israeli occupying forces are not restraining themselves, they're not listening to anyone, and they are continuing with this massacre, and we do not accept that the international community to remain silent and paralyzed and not to act, including the Security Council and different parts of the UN. It is high time for all of them to move forward and to do something and to begin this investigation and to bring those criminals committing crimes against the civilian population to face justice. And it is our collective duty to do everything that we can in order to accomplish that objective. And I will give you a copy of the letter that we sent to the SG. You can make copies and share it among yourself. Yes, Edith, you are the one that...
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. When do you expect your colleague in Geneva to go to the Human Rights Council? Will it be next week, and do you foresee any opposition there to approving an independent commission or to do an independent, transparent investigation?
We were successful in the past of having three different kinds of fact-finding missions and commissions to investigate or crimes committed by the Israeli occupying forces against our people through the Council on Human Rights. It has its own mechanisms in which, you know, an emergency meeting would require a number of countries to assign to agree to have an emergency meeting. Once all these formalities, after consulting with all political groups such as the Arab group and the OIC and others, these mechanisms are now unfolding. My colleague most likely will be calling for an urgent meeting of the Arab Council of Ambassadors early next week, so that to begin this process, and other steps would follow that would be culminated in an emergency meeting of the Council, that in it one can request through a resolution the formation of a body to investigate these crimes. So it takes some time, but at least through the discussion today and after the continuation of these massacres and after Israel announced that it will conduct an investigation which we do not accept, it cannot be independent, it cannot be credible, it has to be an independent, you know, investigation. As the special rapporteurs in the 17th of April communique that they issued in Geneva are saying it has to be done through the UN. In essence, they were saying it has to be done through the Council of Human Rights to authorize the formation of such a commission to begin the process of the investigation.
Which special rapporteur was
all of them? There are several special rapporteurs collectively issued a statement. I have a copy of it for those who wish to have it. I can give it to you to make copies and to share it. And it was very explicit, and it has very important, you know, articulations in it, especially that they do not think that Israel to investigate itself and the conduct of its army would be credible and would be authentic. So therefore, they are asking for an independent investigation through the process of the United Nations, meaning authorized and given a power through a decision in the UN system, such as the Council on Human Rights, or, you know, the Security Council or the General Assembly, so that it would have a mandate through a resolution to conduct this investigation, and then they will continue the work. Abdelhamid.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I mean, history had taught us that Israel doesn't give any attention to these investigation teams. In 2006, Desmond Tutu investigated a Beit Hanun massacre. Nothing happened. In 2009, Goldstone investigated the war in Gaza. Nothing happened. In 2014, Mohammed Shabazz investigated the war in Gaza, and nothing happened. In even 2002, Marty Ihtisari was denied to enter to investigate the Jenin massacre. What is different this time? Nothing will happen. Why the PA, why the Palestinian Authority does not go straight to ICC? Thank you.
You know, one need to pay attention to the technical parts. I believe that Israel recently announced that it will investigate its conduct precisely not to allow the ICC to proceed with investigation, because we all know that in the ICC and the Rome Statute of the ICC, there is the concept of complementarity, which means that if somebody conducting crimes is willing or able to conduct the crime and to do it through the national court system, then the ICC will not come into play. I was telling my colleague in Geneva and others that this is a very sophisticated process in which Israel will make a move, and we have to make a cleverer move than what they do. The move that they made is to neutralize the ICC after the prosecutor made an articulation about two or three weeks ago to consider investigation. So since Israel is saying now that they will conduct an investigation about the conduct of their armed forces and their officers, which they were not considering during the first week of the episodes in Gaza. Now the ICC, in my opinion, of course it is the decision for the ICC to do what they want to do, and I would be delighted if the ICC to engage in an investigation, but it is very conceivable that the ICC now would say we will not go in that direction because Israel is investigating itself. What we are saying, we do not accept Israel to investigate itself, because it is the party that committed the crime. So therefore now, you need to move in the direction of bodies where they can give mandate to the formation of commissions to conduct the investigation. This is one thing. The second thing, of course there is a lot of frustration. You establish commissions to investigate, but Israel does not comply. Does this mean that we have to fold the tent and not to come knocking on the door of the Security Council or the General Assembly or the Council on Human Rights or the ICC? On the contrary, I was telling today a television station in Gaza that called me about a similar sentiment to what you said. I said, at least in my mission here at the United Nations, we learned from the creativity and the resiliency of our people in Gaza. They demonstrate every Friday. If people tell them, well, you did not accomplish anything the first Friday, you did not accomplish anything the second Friday, you did not accomplish anything the third Friday, then the logic of it, there is no sense in continuing this protracted step-by-step continuation of the struggle. I said to them, I learned from your brilliance that I keep knocking on the door of the Security Council. I keep trying to establish a commission to investigate, after another commission, because collectively when we do all these things, one of these days, and hopefully soon, we will reach the point in which the Israeli system of occupation will collapse and we will succeed in ending this occupation and attaining the independence of our state. There's a lot of wisdom in learning from their tenacity and patience and peaceful way of doing things, and I am trying my best to learn from their wisdom as I apply my work as the mission of the State of Palestine to the United Nations. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, thanks a lot. Speaking of the Security Council, as you know, they've gone on retreat, they say, to deal with the most pressing issues. And they've definitely listed Syria, chemical weapons. Ms. Nakamitsu is going. I'm wondering, do you know or have you requested that they deal with this issue while all 15 of them are in Dag Hammarskjöld's farmhouse? And is Mr. Mladenov going? We asked who's going from the Secretariat to raise the issues for them. Do you think that they can deal with this while they're in Sweden, or is it a back burner issue for them?
I don't know what they will deal with in Sweden, but I can tell you that there is an open debate on the 26th of this month in the Security Council. And there will be, I expect, at least 50 countries that will be participating in that open debate for everyone in all corners of the globe to be able to see it openly and live on television, you know, production. I am calling all of my colleagues from all nations to come and participate in that debate and make it a debate that concentrate heavily on several things, including the heroic thing that our people are doing, particularly in the Gaza Strip, peacefully, to express themselves and to fight for their right to return, as it will be culminated in May 15th. So in that open debate, we will deal with all of these issues, those of us who will participate in that debate. I will be meeting with Mladenov on the 25th, bilaterally. I expect him to be the one who will be giving the briefing on behalf of the Secretary General, and judging from the encounter between him and the Chief of Staff of the Israeli Army, it seems that he is coming with a bolder spirit of challenging the atrocities of the Israeli occupying army, particularly in killing children. If he comes with that spirit and give a briefing of that nature, that would be what is needed from the international community to be, you know, shared with the members of the Security Council. But my friend from Kuwait, he is the member of the Security Council, might like, you know, to say a few things in this regard. And he is welcome to say it if he wants, or Maged.
Ambassador, Mr. Ambassador Utaybi last week told us that he will be conducting a meeting with the 10 elected members of the Security Council. Can you update us on that? Thank you.
Sure. I'm not going to add more forever. My colleagues have spoke to about. I'm going to speak as when it comes to the Security Council, as an Arab member of the Security Council. Yes, there is an upcoming E10 meeting. Yes, we are in the progress to hold the meeting. As you have seen, the PR is now in Sweden. So when they are back from Sweden, there is another trip that will be to Myanmar and Bangladesh. So probably after the trip, we'll arrange for an E10 meeting, or in between if their time allows. I just want to reconfirm our position when it comes to the incidents in Palestine. We condemn in the strongest language whatever happening on the ground, the aggression against the Palestinians, and we call for three things. We would like them to be taken immediately, which is immediate protection of the civilian Palestinians and accountability. Without accountability, the occupying power will continue with their action. And last thing is independent investigations. And as you are all aware, we have called for an emergency session. And you are all aware, we tried to produce two press statements. Unfortunately, the council won't be able to agree on it, despite of the overwhelming support we received from our colleagues in the council. If there is any question regarding the council, I will be happy to take it.
I have a question to the Arab League, actually, the ambassador of the Arab League. Thank you. So which steps are you, as an Arab League, willing to take to support Palestinians on the ground, and especially the two countries that have direct relationships with Israel, Jordan and Egypt? Are they going to make any pressure on the Israeli government, since they have direct relationship, to be more helpful and supportive to Palestinian people?
Well, I think that you must have been following what happened in the Arab Summit that happened last Sunday, and the mere fact that the Arab Summit has been called the Jerusalem Summit to start with is a clear reflection and the strongest support that came out in the summit for in support of the Palestinian right for demonstration and in condemnation of the Israeli actions against international law, international humanitarian law, and international human rights law. These are providing the basis for everybody, including even Security Council that is not here, but we expect that the Security Council has taken note of the decisions that have been taken by the Arab summit. As for actions that are taken by the Arab League, we are in continuous support of the Palestinian moves, including in submissions to the Security Council, and we're supportive through the consultations with individual members of the Security Council. As for Egypt and Jordan, I have not been personally in contact with both of them. You might want to ask their ambassadors individually about these issues. Yes, I come from Egypt, but I can't talk for the Egyptian government. Thank you.
It seems the Saudi Arabia Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likes to have a good relationship with Israel. Don't you think this kind of behavior makes your efforts useless?
As the ambassador of the League of Arab States, we had a very successful Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. It was called the Summit of Al-Quds, which reflects that the Arab states are rallying behind the correct position of rejecting the new policy of the Trump administration vis-a-vis Jerusalem. There were 22 pages of paragraphs as part of the final document and resolutions related to the different aspects of supporting the position of the Palestinian people and their leadership. And there were also practical steps in the financial side of supporting our people in Jerusalem and UNRWA after the United States of America cut off a substantial amount of money to UNRWA. We are satisfied with these steps by, the Arab summits that took place in Saudi Arabia. That is a concrete political and materialistic support for the cause of the Palestinian people demonstrated by all the Arab nations, and we are grateful for that. Let me also add on another subject. We will continue as Arabs. We were mandated in this summit to do everything possible in order, to explain why Israel does not qualify for a seat in the Security Council. If a country like Israel, which has an atrocious record in not respecting, honoring, and implementing Security Council resolutions on different issues, including Jerusalem and other issues, and for the Israeli government and their representative who attack the Security Council day in and day out continuously, and violate international law and violate the will of the international community as it is reflected by the so many resolutions of the United Nations, including the Security Council. A country that behaves in this manner and violates all the rules of the club does not qualify to run to be an officer in that club. And in fact, for any club that a member to behave that way would be fired and kicked out from that club for not playing by the rules and the provisions of that club. Therefore, we have been instructed to act in a very effective way in order to intensify our campaigns for saying those who should be in the Security Council should honor and respect and implement Security Council resolutions as it is asked for as an obligation in the Charter of the UN. And we will continue to campaign in this regard in all possible ways and, to support those who do qualify to be in the Security Council, and Israel is not one of them. That's the last question.
Last question to my Tunisian ambassador. Your country is well known to be a very respected country around the world with the rule of law, and maybe you have a good relation with the United States. Does international law have two meanings? I mean, one applies to North Korea and Syria, and one applies to the Palestinian. How cannot you argue so strongly with some member of the Security Council who tried to give two different definitions? One applied to North Korea and Syria and chemical weapons, but not when it comes to the Palestinians. Thank you.
You know, we're not finding out now that there, the double standard in United Nations and other institutions. It's part of international relations, and we are coping with it as a group, as a whole. We know that we are calling, the most important thing is, and this is a call of not only the Arab group, of a call of majority of member states here, to bridge the gap between international agenda and national agenda, or to find the best balance between the two of them. And this is what we are doing here. This is reality on the ground. We have our ambition, we have our expectation. The main thing, the main task of our group is to uphold international law, the international humanitarian law, and international human rights. And we will not give up to this. This is our main task here, our mandate. Of course, in upholding all these instruments and tools, this is the basis of our support of the Palestinian question and the Jerusalem question during this month and during the next month and years. It's a constant position of all of us because of Palestine and because we believe that is the international legality and the international law and respect and the upholding for the human rights law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Edith, give Abdelhamid a copy, please.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Are the mainstream media playing out roles found in the great Russian novel, The Possessed? Voicing dissent against media orthodoxies has never been more dangerous. And is peace breaking out on the Korean Peninsula? Crosstalking Media Madness. I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And we have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. I'm calling this program The Possessed because the mainstream media, corporate mainstream media, are possessed because all of their narratives, or virtually all of their narratives, of the main stories that we've been covering on this program are in tatters. Falling apart. I've never seen this kind of environment, Mark. And we have an example here with Moon of Alabama, which we'll discuss at length, because I think it's a marvelous piece of investigative, thoughtful, intellectual journalism. Mark.
Yeah, I think we're really in a phase that I like to call shooting the messenger, because the narratives of the Western governments in both the so-called Skripal incident at Salisbury in the UK and the incident in Douma in Syria, which led to illegal U.S. strikes, U.S., U.K. and French strikes on Syria, both involve alleged use of chemical weapons with no evidence, and the narratives in both cases are collapsing.
Right.
And this has led...
But if you point that out...
Yes. If you point that out, this is because the narratives are collapsing, the watchdogs of the regimes, the media that does stenography for them, the establishment mainstream media, has gone all out on ad hominem, on the alternative media, anyone on social media with any type of influence or following who is daring to challenge their narrative of what has happened here. And they are getting vituperative. They're getting personal. And it coincides across a whole host of people, a whole host of media, but also with Facebook and Twitter selectively banning them as well.
A lot of these criticisms
were
really quite sloppy and not based in fact.
Oh, it's incompetent.
It's incompetent.
I think we should elaborate a little bit for our viewers on which particular narratives are collapsing.
Sure.
Well, in Duma, the Russian journalists have found one of the boys who was on the video.
Two of them now.
You know, well, I mean, he was on the video that was shown around the world, like people sprinkling each other with water, crying chemical attack, chemical attack. Well, the boy didn't know anything about the chemical attack. He was dragged by other people who promised him food. He was dragged into that hospital. He was sprinkled with water. He's quite alive, you know, despite the fact that, you know, the Western media kept saying that these people are going to die.
Crisis actor, okay?
Absolutely.
Right.
With Skripal affair, we have been told by the British now that there is evidence that Russia was involved, but it was an attacking group, and all its members are back in Russia. I think the next time they do something with white helmets, they should evacuate all the actors right to France or to the UK, where international media would not be able to
find them. It's remarkable the amount of information that has been revealed about the true force behind the white helmets. It's common knowledge if you make any kind of effort, but they continue to support them mainstream media as a power for good. It's just a propaganda
outfit.
The
point is that in all of these stories, all the witnesses are somehow inaccessible. They're in Russia, or they are somewhere else, you know, or they can't be shown because they're in danger, like Yulia Skripal. She is healthy now.
You know, Dima, the truth is dangerous.
Absolutely.
In this case, okay? Well,
if Yulia Skripal has survived, if she's in good health, why doesn't she give a press conference? Why don't they show her? Okay, maybe not to the Russian diplomats. Okay, to Western journalists. No, they keep her in safe location. They talk about the attacking group of Russians who are somehow all in Russia.
And we don't even know if she's being held against her will. Okay, we don't even know that. Let me give a piece here from this Moon of Alabama. This is an article. It's April 21st of this year. The Media War on Truthful Reporting and Legitimate Opinions, a documentary. Really interesting piece here. Those working in the media are up in arms over alleged fake news, and they lament the loss of paying readership. But they have only themselves to blame. They are the biggest creators of fake news and providers of government falsehood. Their attacks on critical readers and commentators are despicable. And further in the article, the vicious campaign against any dissenting report or opinion is a sorry attempt to go back in time and to again gain the monopoly on truth. And this is, we've mentioned this many times on this program.
Let me give you an example. Just this week, a BBC journalist in Moscow, Steve Rosenberg, he interviewed someone named Vladimir Uglev, who claims that he made Novichok. Probably that same portion that almost killed the Skripals in London. But, as Uglev says in that interview, you will never prove it. Well, that's useful for the BBC, that you will never prove it. But somehow he spread it all over his hand when he made it, and he just quickly put it into some kind of acid. I think it was basically chlorine acid, hydrochloric acid, and all impurity magically went away. So the good thing is that
I think his hand would too, but
you know,
not a chemist.
Under democracy or with Democrats, you have even different laws of chemistry than in totalitarian societies, like the Russian one. Under democracy, chemistry doesn't work because you get infested with a deadly nerve agent, but you don't die. Maths don't work because, you know, Obama said that Russian economy is in tatters. Actually, the Russian agriculture and food industry added up. But since maths don't work in a totalitarian society, of course, we all should believe Obama.
Okay, you know this passage that I read that I think, you know, they really want to regain their position as the Ministry of Truth here. And it is very much under assault. What I find remarkable is that
we're in this media environment now because the main news providers, the establishment, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Or they have to backtrack, they have to amend.
Because they're not doing their job.
They're not doing their job. And then they want things just to go away, okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a number of cases, the longer you look, the harder you look, the official line is severely in doubt. Yeah.
They're not doing their jobs because they are not being critical of their own power centers, right? Which leads people to look and people to rise up on their own and start doing citizen journalism, basically, and then rising up into the alternative media because there are no critical voices. This is why so many people want to appear, for instance, on Russian media or alternative media centers, because that's the only place where they can get a platform to voice dissent from the narrative that this media is not only doing stenography for, but is doing active defense for. And I think we need to name out some of the people that were attacked in the last week or two, because the list is quite extensive. And it's so extensive and so across the board that I think that there obviously is some pattern, shall we say, here. Something
well,
is
it's
at work.
It's certainly not a coincidence.
Anel Changa and Eugene Perrier in the United States, these are both black rights activists who have been attacked by NPR, of all people, among
NPR
others,
Philly,
just for appearing on Russian media.
Absolutely.
Vanessa Beely and Eva Bartlett. The UK academics, Tim Hayward and Piers Robinson. There was a Times of London headline right on the front page against them. Big letters beneath a decision whether you're a Meghan Markle jewelry or some other monarch. Apologists for Assad working in our universities. Then the subtitle, top academics claim chemical attacks were fakes. Right. So that makes them Assad apologists. Sarah Abdallah. A prominent Syrian Lebanese social media
activist.
Yeah, Syrian girl partisan Maryam Suzli, a Syrian Australian citizen, and Ian Schelling, going by the Twitter handle at Ian5678.
But the reaction to these here is that what I saw, the attacks on the individuals that you just mentioned right there, they're not fact-based. As a matter of fact, they make a lot of mistakes
They're pure ad hominem and incompetent.
Right.
Craig Murray, Peter Ford, Peter Hitchens, Valentina Lisitsa, the East Ukrainian pianist, Robert Fisk.
The interesting thing is that I'd be willing to say with great certainty that the only thing that all of those people have in common, it is not Russia.
No.
It is the truth.
They buck the
stenographers that write for the powers that be. So, you know, I think it's very interesting if you took at all of the views of those people.
Right,
they don't have a lot in common,
across
actually.
The board. Jimmy Dore of the very popular show, progressive show on YouTube. This is what CNN Money. Exclusive. YouTube ran ads from hundreds of brands on extremist channels, which they identified as Jimmy Dore. As an extremist. Ads also appeared on the Jimmy Dore Show channel, a far-left YouTube channel.
I've been on that program a number of times.
That peddles conspiracy theories.
He is a hardcore progressive guy here. Let me give the last word before
we go
to the break.
I think that we should dwell not only on the victims, but also on the people who do it. You know, the story with Anel Changa that you just mentioned, she is a black progressive activist who was on BBC or on a lot of mainstream media channels talking about marginalization of people, talking about police brutality. Her only crime was that she twice appeared on Sputnik. You know, she spoke to the radio, Sputnik US, in Washington, D.C., and that was enough for an affiliate of NPR in Atlanta, its author, Johnny Kaufman, just went after her for speaking to Russians, basically, even though she was not
I speak to Russians all the time. It's
even
all right.
Though she was not interviewed by a Russian person. And he never mentioned, you know, what he did. He called the people who had interviewed her before, and he asked them, would you have the same attitude to her if you knew that she spoke to Sputnik?
Okay, Nima, hold that thought. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on media madness. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
I don't know if to laugh or to take pity, but now we have the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. They're suing Russia, suing WikiLeaks.
And Trump.
And his relatives.
Right. When I first came across that story, obviously the first thing that comes to mind is that they still want to relitigate the election of 2016. I guess we're going to get that for this entire run-up to the midterm elections at the end of the year. But at the same time, the second thought that came into my mind was, well, why didn't the DNC let the FBI examine their servers? And that has never been resolved here. Is this just another fishing expedition? I mean, suing the Russian government, I don't think that's going to be even remotely possible in this case.
Okay, well, of course, this lawsuit, I don't think that you are taking this seriously enough, Peter. Because the Democratic National Committee is suing for damages because, as they quite rightly point out, incredible damage was done to them, allegedly.
We don't know that. Russia, there's no evidence
of that. Well, there's no evidence of that, right? Russia and WikiLeaks, according to them, colluded to expose email that exposed that the DNC rigged their own primary against Bernie Sanders in collusion with the Hillary Clinton campaign, which had effectively financially taken over the DNC at the time. As reported by the DNC chair that took over after the previous one was forced to resign in disgrace, right? This is what they're suing Russia and WikiLeaks over?
Well, it's really interesting, Dima. You have from the left this narrative of WikiLeaks Russia. There's been never any evidence of that whatsoever. Julian Assange, everything that he's done with WikiLeaks in the last decade tells me very clearly that he would never get in bed with any government at all. And there's never been any evidence that he ever has.
That's why he was so popular.
And successful.
That's why he had so many volunteers working for him, dozens, hundreds, in different countries. But, you know, this story, when I heard that they were suing the Russian government and Trump, you know, sometimes when I see people suing everyone, I sometimes think, why don't you sue your parents for you being such an idiot, you know? This is the same kind of story. Bernie Sanders, of all people, you know, it was his victory that was stolen from him. And we know it from these WikiLeaks revelations, which were all true, you know, they were not falsified. They were not in any way questioned by the DNC. They are all true. But Bernie Sanders kept accusing Russia for interfering in the U.S. election during all of the last year. Well, isn't it a defeat? Isn't it a capitulation? Instead of fighting for the victory that was stolen from you, you praise the people who stole this victory from you. I'm sorry, he reminded me of the Russian communist leader Gennady Zyuganov in 1996, who obviously lost to Yeltsin simply because he was afraid to win, you know, because at the time the oligarchs, people like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, they were not nice freedom fighters as now, you know, from their comfortable hotel. They were sinister people who could kill him if he really won, you know. That's why he didn't want to win. He didn't win, and he never questioned his defeat. This is the same story with Bernie Sanders.
But the interesting thing is with this lawsuit, it is a direct frontal assault on freedom of expression. And this is what, you know, this is the most important takeaway, because we get down again. WikiLeaks is a media outlet. It generating news here. This has been contested here. If this is the case, and you can equate WikiLeaks as some kind of non-state actor, then that is then we have this slippery slope of attacking speech. Because when we look at we had the major WikiLeaks dump. That we had about the Iraq war. I mean, New York Times, The Guardian, Le Monde, everybody picked it up, okay? Mm-hmm. So are they going to be just as equally guilty because of their association or some kind of working relationship they had with WikiLeaks?
Yeah, well, first of all, this lawsuit is ridiculous, of course, right? First of all, it's premised on the idea that there's some kind of Trump-Russia conclusion. That's at least part of it, something that the Mueller investigation hasn't turned up a single piece of evidence for. So, you know, that takes us right there. It's about the midterm elections. It's all about generating headlines and continuing this broken neo-McCarthyite narrative. They think that's going to win them votes come November. I think it's going to ruin them. But this does have wider implications, not just for freedom of speech and the press, but also for whistleblowers as well, right? There is a whole history of everything from the Pentagon Papers to the Panama Papers to the printing of Donald Trump's parts of his financial record, to all kinds. Media outlets exist. A good part of what they do and has always been is putting information from governments, from companies, from individuals that they obtain through, you know, not completely legal means, right? Whistleblowers aren't considered legal. God knows Obama went after enough of them more than any other U.S. all the U.S. other presidents combined during his administration. But they've always done this. And if you are now suddenly making this illegal, then every media organization in the world that does or has ever published information that they acquired by whistleblowing or other such method.
But that's what they want. But they want to be the Ministry of Truth. I really want to talk a little bit about North Korea here. Dima, is peace breaking out on the Korean Peninsula? It's really quite amazing the pace of this right now. I mean, let's look at the first part of the year and the kind of labels and exchanges we had with Trump and the Korean leader here. Now it seems to be going into a new direction. Can the U.S. will the U.S. accept a peace process that the Korean people want?
Well, just look how easily the modern West is creating enemies. And if Kim Jong-un really thinks that he can be the first one that can be kind of converted from an enemy to friend, he should look at the experience of Gorbachev, who also started his peace campaign with the United States by refusing to have more nuclear tests in 1986.
Gaddafi falls in the same category here.
Absolutely. But let me tell you, look how the number of the West's enemies multiplied in the last 5 years alone. Russia and China have been called threats for a long time, okay. But now the EU is calling the Polish government a threat, the Hungarian government a threat,
and Turkey, its greatest adversaries are its allies.
Absolutely.
Here.
So if Kim Jong-un really thinks that he can be an exception, that he can make peace with the West, you know, he is simply making the same mistake that Gorbachev made.
You know, Mark, I think it's really interesting. I think the North Koreans learned a lot from the Iranians, because the Iranians never wanted a nuclear weapon, so they started a program so they could give it away for sanction relief. It was really smart, by the way.
And for security.
But it seems to me the Koreans are doing exactly the same thing. They create a perceived threat, and then they say, okay, we'll take it off the table. We want security guarantees. But the real trick in all of this is going to be is how the North and South, they negotiate their terms and conditions for a peace, because the two countries are still technically at war right now. Kim Jong-un was in Beijing recently. I think that he was telling the Chinese what they're going to do. And the deal is going back to what the Russians and the Chinese already proposed at the end of last year. And this is
it
what's going to be.
Trump's proposal.
And Trump's going to get all the credit for it. I don't care. I don't care what the mainstream media has to say. If there can be a process, it should be applauded.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not only North Korea and South Korea, but of course the U.S. that's also at war with North Korea. There's only an armistice settling there. I'm not so sure that Iran created a story about, you know, the perception that they had a nuclear weapons program.
They were going through the motions. Yes, I don't deny that.
That was a fiction created by the Western government.
But there's ample evidence that they have never actually had that as their ultimate goal.
What I think Trump is trying to take credit for some breakthrough here, right? First of all, any credit deserved goes to Russia and China for the quiet negotiations and the new South Korean leader who is willing to actually have conversations with his North Korean counterpart. And that's the real hope for negotiations. Trump's bluff and bluster, that's everything has happened despite that.
Agreed.
Second of all, the supposed success of North Korea suddenly declaring that they're done testing, they're no longer going to test nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles, that's not because of Trump's irate tweets and threats to wipe Pompeo's visit. It's due to the fact that they achieved what they wanted. They have a nuclear deterrent. The U.S. can't take that away from them without a war that would end up destroying hundreds of thousands of millions of South Koreans.
The North Koreans want a denuclearized peninsula. That's going to be very difficult for the Pentagon to swallow.
If I were them, looking at Libya, Iraq, Iran,
this is going to be very difficult to get there.
I wouldn't give up.
I think the China and Russia being guarantors, I think, is important in this case. We'll see where it goes.
If there was any outside influence on Kim Jong Un, which pushed him to stop nuclear tests, it was from China. And probably from Russia. It was not, pressure from the United States, from Japan.
I think you're right. Yeah.
It was obvious, the regimes like that, they can resist outside pressure for decades, as we know. Well, the problem is that, if you look at it from the point of view of Russia and the look that the Russian media is taking at it, we're not whitewashing the North Korean regime. It is a totalitarian communist regime, the one that we know, that we have known it for many years. But the problem is that there are many kinds of predators. There were Nazi predators, there are communist predators, and there are ultra-liberal predators who are the most dangerous now. It's like, in the animal world, amphibians, reptiles. Who are the most dangerous predators now? The mammals, the newest ones. So with the West, you have the mammal reptiles, the most dangerous ones.
The most dangerous beings are liberals. Okay,
absolutely.
They're the worst. Okay.
They are the worst because they used to have a good reputation, including in Russia, because they use the most kind of sophisticated rhetoric, and they have control over the media.
We've run out of time for our broadcast version here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.